This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the front of eulogizing retrospection, it's been the week of Coretta Scott King, and rightly so. But there's another woman, another superwoman, who died last Saturday, having changed the world. Feminist Betty Friedan blew the doors off the lives of quiet desperation of American women of the 1950s. Her earth-shaking book, The Feminine Mystique, pulled the trigger on history, said Alvin Toffler, and sent a generation of women storming out of the kitchen and into the political and economic fray. Now, a new generation of women is picking and choosing from the feminist revolution. Up next on Point, a conversation of women across generations on the legacy of Betty Friedan. With me today in the studio, three women of note from two generations. Carol Rivers is professor of journalism at Boston University and author of Same Difference, How Gender Myths Are Hurting Our Relationships, Our Children, and Our Jobs with Rosalind Barnett. She is at work on a forthcoming book, Monsters, Mommies, and Madonnas, about the media's representation of women. Carol, you're not exactly Betty Friedan's class in school, but we're putting you in her corner. Thank you very much with us. Also with us, Masoum Mamaya, a 28-year-old doctoral student at the Harvard School of Education. She's writing her dissertation on young women's activism. She's on the board of the Third Wave Foundation, an organization that supports young women and transgender education. Masoum, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And with us is Megan Greer, a 23-year-old first-year law student at Harvard Law School. She's a member of the Alliance of Independent Feminists, a student organization of self-described moderate, conservative, and libertarian women. Megan Greer, wonderful to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So here we are. Carol, start us off. Betty Friedan, gone almost a week ago now, at 85, on her 85th birthday, the woman who talked about the problem that has no name. We've heard a lot in the last year, and not just in the last year, about a kind of generation gap opening up over this legacy, whether young women are forgetting what it was for women before, whether young women, some young women, are turning around on the kind of legacy of the women's movement. I guess for starters, do you think young women today understand what it was Betty Friedan was talking about, that life of the 1950s?
No, I think it's very hard to understand it. Remember, the world before Betty Friedan wrote her book was a world in which women couldn't be on television because their voices didn't have any authority. Women couldn't run the Boston Marathon. Women couldn't be commercial pilots. Women couldn't be Supreme Court justices. Major schools, law, professional schools allowed only token women in. There was a virtual apartheid in America where women were confined to a small domestic role, and almost all the important powerful roles in academia, government, sciences were utterly closed. And I think that seems so bizarre to today's women who take for granted so much of how the world's changed.
When you look out, do you fear that women of a younger generation who didn't live through that, who didn't have to break out of that, may risk losing it by kind of, you know, we hear about women wandering back home or going back home to take care of the kids, to celebrate the domestic life, to, they looked at their own mother's experience and said, that's too much. You can't do it all. Are younger women, from your perspective, turning around on the legacy, the gift of that generation? Your generation.
They can't, because men's incomes have been declining or stagnant for 30 years. Women are going to live to be 90. They're probably going to have two children. Women are going to have to support themselves. On the other hand, I think that it's an incomplete revolution. So I'd like to see young women fighting politically for things like, you know, decent early education, some of the things that make work and family really possible and not such a real struggle.
Megan Greer, you're 23. You're looking ahead at all this. You've read the obituaries and heard the eulogies in the last week, no doubt. And for a long time, women of your generation are looking at this legacy. How do you see it? Do you see Betty Friedan as a hero? Do you see the women's liberation movement as the liberation of women or something else?
Well, I think there are a lot of elements in Betty Friedan's legacy that a lot of women can be proud of. She definitely started a nationwide conversation that has certainly helped to liberate women across the country and throughout the world. At the same time, I do worry about how her legacy has been taken by certain aspects of the women's movement and transformed.
In particular, what do you mean?
I think there is an element of radical feminism that has taken Betty Friedan's work and has twisted it in a way that I don't even think Ms. Friedan intended.
Along what lines? With what kind of issues?
Well, for instance, Betty wrote a book called The Second Stage, in which she expressed displeasure at the way the women's movement was losing sight of the family. And Betty was very concerned about keeping the balance of still being a mother and still being a wife and having a job outside of the home. And that's something that I think has largely been dismissed by the current women's movement.
So are you saying it's time for women to look home again unapologetically, to be at home with the kids? How do you parse this?
Well, I think it's a great time for women. I think that women have a great choice to make. I think that educational opportunities for women, professional opportunities for women, are at a level that we've never seen before. But we also need to respect the choices that women make.
Respect them. Masum Mamaya, there's the critique that Betty Friedan named it and framed it, and then women's liberation got kind of hijacked and taken it off. You're in the third wave, looking at women, women's rights, transgender issues. Are you part of the hijacking?
Yes and no. I think that third wave feminists tend to respect the legacy of Betty Friedan and many of the second wave feminists that were part of the agitation in the beginning of the revolution in the 60s and the 70s. But I think that third wave feminists have called for a departure from the conversation and a broadening of the conversation that Betty Friedan started. Including, I think the issue of choice, as Megan raised, is a central question. And I think that third wave feminists believe that there is still much work to be done. While they're grateful for all of the advances in education and employment, they still feel like choice is a fictitious concept for
and
a
when
lot of women.
Choice, you mean choice in terms of abortion in particular, or choice in terms of career and home?
All of the above.
The whole works. And do you see... Do you see some of your peers in your age group, I don't know, from your perspective, dropping the ball or turning around, dropping the torch on the women's liberation movement? Do you see women going home and saying, to heck with all that, or is that just a media mirage?
No, I think it's true. I think it is true among certain groups of women. I think that it speaks to the fact that the revolution is incomplete and that some of the psychological stresses and tensions associated with having to seek it all, have it all, do it all, are difficult on an individual level. And that I think third wave feminists would say that there's still not a lot of structural support in place to be able to take advantage of all the gains that, you know, we're supposed to be taking advantage of.
Carol Rivers, give us the advantage of your perspective, your vantage of years here. What do you see going on? Do you see women kind of splitting up over these issues? Because, I mean, we all know how individual women can be torn over these. So are women as a group being sort of torn apart by the difficulty of spanning all of these threads?
I think that's really exaggerated. My daughter, for example, finds that among her friends are people who stay home, people who work. It's not an issue. They really say this is your choice.
Mm-hmm.
I think the structural issue is a very big one. I was recently talking to a French couple, and the woman in the couple, they had two kids, had absolutely no issues about childcare because being French, mm-hmm. she had early childhood education from early on.
Government provided.
She had health care. And what we do find is that in American families, the number one stressor in dual income families is lack of affordable childcare. So I think what we really need to do is talk about structural supports so women and men, because men are mm-hmm. now taking more of a part in raising kids, so families can just not struggle over these issues. And interestingly, corporate America is starting to recognize this.
But do you see no gap between the generations here? Or is there a kind of different understanding of what's at stake?
I think that younger women accept, you know, as their birthright, a lot of these issues. I mean, I don't think there's any younger woman who would expect to go in as I did, you know, to a job and be told, we won't hire you because you're a woman, even though you're more qualified than our male applicants.
Period, end of story.
A period, end of story. And I think that that's, I mean, it's almost like the Civil War to younger women. Those battles have been won. And I think that what we're dealing with, now, I think the media way exaggerates the battles between women. It's a non-story as far as most young women are concerned. There's no mommy versus mommy war. It's a media creation.
Media creation, and yet there's still the struggle to deal with all these avenues that are now open. Linda's calling from Millis, Massachusetts. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate having such a wonderful tribute to Betty Friedan. Personally, she impacted my life in, I guess, an indirect way. A neighborhood woman that I was very friendly with as a teenage girl in the early 70s had Betty Friedan's book and handed it to me one day and said, here, it's too late for me. You read it. And I guess I'd always been a feminist but had not been able to put that word to that, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the book at that 14-year-old age and became, you know, very upset and angry, and realized over the years that I've really internalized her definition of feminism. And I get very concerned that the feminist message to me, which is that feminism is an opportunity for everyone to grow and to become fully human, and that feminism is wonderful for women. It allows us to experience all facets of life, but it also allows men to break free from their roles and experience their complete human life and experience. And to me, that's the most important message of feminism. And I'm a school teacher, and I tell that to my students, and I tell that to anybody who'll listen.
And Linda, what is it, again, that upsets you about the way it's playing out today?
Well, to be a feminist, if a young girl says that, I hear perhaps subtle sneering or perhaps blatant sneering. Young girls will say, oh, I'm not a feminist, I don't need that anymore, don't understand what the definition of a feminist is for both men and women. And that it really benefits everyone. If you want to stay home and care for your children as a husband, you should be celebrated just as much as if a woman stays home and cares for her children, or if you work. But it allows everybody to be fully human and experience everything and be who they are, and help us all break free of roles.
So feel free to get on that bandwagon.
Yeah, I feel that message oftentimes gets lost, and people look down on feminists and have a stereotype of the feminist.
Linda, let me bring our panel in here. Megan, you're 23. Do you hear that kind of ambivalence about feminism or being a feminist among your women of your generation?
I think so, and I think that's a big problem. Something that Carol touched on is the way that the women's movement and feminism in particular is played out in the media. And I think that's something that's been very damaging to the women's movement, because we see two very extreme opposites. We see the National Organization for Women, or NOW, on the left, and we see organizations like Concerned Women for America on the right. And the vast majority of women in this country, I don't think, fit perfectly in line with either organization. Many women are in the center, and they don't have a strong organization to represent them.
And what, in your view, are the two different interpretations of feminism, as you describe it, held by those ends of the spectrum?
Well, I think one side is the left is often portrayed as trying to promote women's rights above rights of men and trying to make up for past discrimination. And on the extreme right, they're seen as hampering the women's movement and trying to keep women in typical gender roles.
And Masoom, sorry.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, because to describe that in the left-right spectrum, I think that the feminists in the third wave would say that the left isn't far left enough, and that the organizational left isn't left enough. And I think that it's precisely the expansiveness of the definition of feminism that Linda was alluding to that third-wave feminists have embraced.
Not left enough about around one what parameters, what issues, what frontiers?
I think that third-wave feminists have really called for a revisioning of feminism to not just include gender justice, but to also include racial justice, economic justice, justice for transgender individuals, attention to things like religion, immigration status, sexual identity, all of the things that third wave feminists feel like are indivisible, are intersectional in terms of how people live and experience the world. And I think that third wave feminists would agree that sometimes second wave organizations on the left have been too exclusively focused on women versus men to the detriment of neglecting some other forms of inequality that are equally important.
You're saying it's a big field and let's pull it all in. Lori's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Lori, you're on the air.
Hi, I have kind of two comments. I think, first of all, if you can't, you know, if you can't answer the call, you tend to knock it.
What do you mean by that, Lori?
What I mean is, you know, I'm 40, mm-hmm. and as I was, you know, 20, in my 20s, I would hear about Betty Friedan as kind of a has-been. Like, oh, you know, she kind of got the ball rolling, but, oh, she was just so crazy and extreme. You know, we don't do that anymore. And when I actually read her, I found it not crazy or extreme at all, and that, you know, she was, I think her, you know, her message is not that you can't, you know, have a family, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that she gets so misinterpreted is that, you know, the media, just like they misinterpret most things that scare them, turn her into a crazy man hater. And, I mean, that brings me to my second point. I think it's the comment I just heard is pretty astounding that women shouldn't be focused on women's issues. Women's issues really include everything else. You know, it's like, don't fight for women's issues. That's so old hat, you know. Never mind that the job's not done and women still aren't equal. You know, don't focus on women so selfishly. You've got to focus. I mean, nobody says to civil rights activists, don't just focus on race. That's crazy. You should be focusing on, you know, everybody else.
Well, let's hear it. Masuma, is that what you're saying?
No, that's. I don't think that's what I'm saying.
Stick with us, Lori.
I think the idea was not to focus on men versus women and that form of equality exclusively. It's not to say that that is not important, that all of the battles have been won, that there isn't work to do in those areas. I think all of that is true. But I think women coming of age, young women coming of age now feel like there are multiple forms of inequality that really affect their lives, their experiences, their access to opportunities. And any analysis that ignores that other form.
Others being the, on the transgender front,
on the race front,
the economic front.
Sexual identity as well, that all of those things that ignore those forms of experience, those forms of inequality, are not going to be effective in terms of political work.
Lori, do you want to put your feminist umbrella over all that?
No, I think those are human rights issues, and I think everybody should be focused on them as human rights issues. But it seems to me still to be saying, well, women's rights on its own, men against women, is not completely valid. And I think, well, you know, what is? Again, I point to, you know, let's say civil rights. Nobody ever said, oh, you can't just focus on race. That's not the whole story.
Yeah. Lori, we've got it. Let me turn to Carol Rivers if I may. Carol, sit in that Betty Friedan chair for a second here. Betty did end up on the outs with some swath of feminists. She did have a critique that didn't follow down all of these paths. There was a point at which she said, wait a minute, I'm not sure this is my brand, wasn't there?
This is, you know, feminism was never a one-size-fits-all. And what we may forget at one point, that Betty Friedan was very concerned that gay women might hijack the women's movement and take it to being focused on gay issues. Of course, that turned out not to be a problem. But this also occurred in the civil rights movement. If you remember, when Martin Luther King wanted to go to poverty and the mm-hmm. issues of Vietnam, and people were saying, no, we've got to focus on this issue. So this has been an issue in feminism for a long time, with some groups saying we really need to go beyond to human rights, and others saying, wait a minute, don't take your eye off the ball, because this battle isn't won. And I think this tension really does exist.
Let's keep Betty Friedan's voice in here for just a minute, if I may. Here's Betty Friedan from, I guess, 1971. She co-founded the National Women's Political Caucus. And here's an excerpt of her speech at the group's founding meeting.
My own historic alarm clock, which has rung several times in the past in the presence of some of you, tells me that the women's liberation movement has crested now. We can't go any longer with conscious raising, with talk. If it doesn't become political, it will peter out. It will turn against itself and become nothing. Up until now, the politics of our two-party system, the politics of bosses and machines, has been based on manipulation of minorities by the white minority, the white male minority in power. What unites women as a majority, as evidenced here today, is the refusal to be manipulated any longer.
Betty Friedan speaking there in 1971. Jody is calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Hi, Jody, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you think, Jody?
Well, I think a common theme between the two previous callers and myself included is that when feminism works, it empowers both genders. And I come to this discussion as a 38-year-old mother of two preschoolers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm home with them. And I think that if caretaking of either the elderly or the children weren't so devalued, it wouldn't exclusively be women's work. And I also think that we really can't have it all. There's a time in life where you do things. You're young, you go to school, you go to college, you work, and then you make a commitment, hopefully with a partner, to have a family, and the commitment becomes to the family. And that time passes. So I genuinely think that if we changed our notion about what it means to be a caretaker, we could value raising our children, taking care of our elderly, and it just wouldn't be woman's work.
And do you see feminism as having devalued caretaking or holding it up and putting that value on it?
I am of the school of thought where we really should be holding it up and valuing it.
But has feminism done that? Does it do that?
I guess it depends on who you're talking to. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, For me, it has. It allows me to do what I do with some respect and some dignity and honor what it is that I'm doing.
We hear it, and we applaud it, Jody, and thank you for your call. Megan Greer, what about it? Feminism, on balance, has it helped us value caretaking, that portion of the work of humans?
Important to establish that there is no monolithic women's view. We see this in the political spectrum very clearly. Bush and Kerry split women's votes between single women and married women. Married women mostly voted for Bush, and single women mostly voted for Kerry. Women have very different issues, and it's very hard to say that feminism has either devalued or increased the value of caretaking. I think it's something that we still need to work on, and I think that women's work, whether it be in the workforce or at home, needs to be valued both ways.
Carol, this issue of caretaking, I mean, it just stays right at the heart of this because we don't live in France.
That's right.
And people have to make choices. And for better or for worse, it's still women very often making the sort of bottom line choice. And I have to say, you may call it a media creation, but I sense a real tension here in individuals' lives, but also in society at large about what value to put on that. I do hear some younger women saying, I'm not sure I want to do what my mother did, and maybe now even my grandmother did under the sway of the sort of liberationists of Betty's era.
Well, I think one thing that we're seeing an exaggeration of this movement. For example, Slate's media critic Jack Schaefer said just recently, why is the New York Times trying to get women home to the kitchen? You saw a front page story in the New York Times saying that 60% of Ivy League women want to just be housewives. Mm. The statistics were absolutely bogus.
Mm-hmm.
You saw another story in the New York Times saying that men don't like smart women, all based on a story done on women in their 80s. So I think while there are these tensions in these issues, they're exaggerated, and I really worry about you can't have it all message, because from my life I can tell you if having it all means you can have a happy marriage, you know, you can be a parent, and mm-hmm. you can have a rewarding career, yes, you can. Can you work 90 hours a week as the CEO of some place and be a parent? Probably not if you're male or female, but I worry about the message being sent to women that you have to choose. You either have to be a mommy or you have to work, and never the twain shall meet. And I worry about that because millions of us know that's not true.
Megan Greer, do you see women your age anticipating that they have to make a choice here, that they can't have it all, that they are going to do one or the other, or is that too simple?
I think it's a little too simple. I think that it's an issue that women confront very differently, and I think it's a personal choice that each woman needs to make for herself. But I think that the stories that Carol referenced, even if the statistics were bogus, I don't necessarily think that the stories were trying to say that, that women should stay home. I think quite the opposite. I think that the story was saying, the New York Times story regarding Ivy League women who are choosing to stay at home later, I think that completely devalues their education and indicates that if they have gone to such lengths to gain an Ivy League education and then choose to stay at home, that's a waste of their education. And I think that's a very dangerous message to send to young women.
So you're saying the opposite. Staying home is okay. It doesn't mean you've devalued your education. That, as our caller from Des Moines, Jody, said, there are many phases in life as well. I mean, many ways to weave all this together. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Masoom, the caretaking issue, is it still central to the third wave feminist outlook, or is it just one among many?
I think that it's central to all members of society. I don't think it's just a third wave issue. I think that it's true that in the U.S., the majority of people who have children are stressed out about what they're going to do for childcare, how they're going to afford it, whether it hurts the child's development for them to go out and work and leave the child in a daycare facility. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's just a third wave issue. And I think it's I see it as a reflection of the fact that society is moving in the direction of favoring individual responsibility and that political decisions are being made to let individuals and families figure it out.
Victoria is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Victoria. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about having lost two voices in Coretta Scott King and in Betty Friedan for lesbian rights. In their own way, you know, to some extent, more or less. And I wonder if the three guests today can speak to whether fighting for lesbian rights in the name of feminism is something we can all agree on. Or would Megan especially say that this is a hijacking?
Megan?
I think that at this time, I think it would be a hijacking. I think that the larger women's movement still has a ways to go, but I think that we're only going to get there if we work together. And I think that adopting the more divisive issues at this time would be dangerous. And I think that at a time where the two ends of the spectrum are so polarized, and I think we really need to try to work to find some common ground before we move on to the more, you know, quote-unquote divisive issues.
Masoom?
I think the common ground is human rights. I think that fighting for the rights of gay, lesbian, and transgender individuals is critical to any and all forms of fighting for equality and justice in society. I don't think that I also feel like I agree that the country is fairly polarized, but I think that there are groups and organizations that need to hold the radical line. I think that
Carol, you know, what about it? Has lesbian rights been a significant sticking point in the kind of women's movement cause?
Much less so, I think, than in the early days. When you see that Lynn Cheney is standing up for her lesbian daughter, mm-hmm. what we're seeing is that so many people all across the political spectrum have gay children, gay friends, gay aunts, gay uncles, gay bosses, that I think that is not I really don't see it as a major problem that women's organizations speak up for the rights of gay and lesbian women. I think it is much less divisive, ironically, than it would have been 30 years ago.
Megan, how about it? Lynn Cheney is on the sort of director's emerite of your parent organization. So does that mean that conservatives are all right with this now?
Well, let me just clarify. I definitely believe that lesbian rights should be advanced. I just don't think that we should sacrifice other women's issues in place of them.
What did Betty Friedan come around to in the end, Carol?
Oh, in the end, I think Betty...
She pushed back for a while.
Yeah, she pushed back for a while. Betty was a brilliant marketer. She really saw that the women's movement had to be a broad, centrist movement to be mm-hmm. successful mm-hmm. and that you had to appeal to middle-class women. I think in her later years, she realized that she broadened her focus to say that, sure, gay issues should be a part of our agenda because it's a part of the nation's agenda as well.
And what about the evolution overall? When you look at where Betty began with her sort of out-of-the-box, big, you know, boom of the feminine mystique, the first interpretations of that, the first decade. Where's the movement come now? What there has been evolution, obviously. How would you describe or define it?
Well, it has moved, and there is an interesting division now among feminists. Those feminists who see themselves more interested in sort of the justice, gender equity issues, and others who, like Carol Gilligan, define themselves as sort of different feminists who are saying, see, women are more relational, women are in fact better than men. And I tend to disagree with the difference wing because I think it's based on lousy science. I don't think women are better or more moral or more caring, and I think it's dangerous to go down that path.
Does that make you old school, Betty Friedan school? Would she be on the same beam there? Was she?
Oh, absolutely. I think she would worry about the fact that if you define women as the world's moral caretakers, you're stuck back in the compassion trap of having to care for everybody and not be able to care for yourself.
The mystique of the kinder, sweeter, more moral.
Yes.
Robin's calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're good.
One of the things that, as I was listening to our conversation, my struggle is my mother was a part of the feminist movement. She didn't so much focus on Ferdinand, but she focused a lot on Gloria Steinem, and she was also a Black Panther. I, however, am a conservative Christian, dealing with having to be in the home with my children. I'm a mortgage broker now, so I go to work from 10 to 2:30, and then I rush home to take care of the children. So I understand the conversation. And here in the South, one of my comments is that when you talk about feminism, it's synonymous to a lesbian type of radical, aggressive women who won't stay home and take care of their children. And I think that the movement is still important, and I don't think that it should be mixed with, Black rights. And I'm Black as I want to be. I've been Black all day. But the point is that when you talk about the women's right movement, it's very important that we do take a stance on child care and make certain that we get quality child care. I had to take my children out of the child care position that they were in because they weren't getting the type of quality care that they needed. But then when my husband runs into, we need more money in the home, then I have to be thrown back out in the workforce. I went to school for political science, and I'm a mortgage broker.
Right.
I had to make a choice so that the money can come in the home. So if you would speak to those issues.
Robin, we hear it. Stick with us for a second. Masoom, Robin's mom, feminist, Black Panther, Robin, conservative Christian, and concerned that the very sort of label feminism, at least in her neck of the woods, connotes something that's not mainstream, that doesn't maybe help her push feminism as a mainstream agenda.
Yeah, I think that speaks to a lot of the media distortion of the label and not necessarily what the substance of the movement is about.
She's talking about your interpretation of the movement.
The distortion of focus against childcare,
She's saying it's synonymous with lesbianism and kind of aggressive. I'm not here to pin this on you, but you are carrying the torch for some of the issues that Robin, as a conservative Christian, is saying bend the image of feminism away from the center of her community.
This is a real issue, I think. I mean, she's really talking about what people are facing today. This is exactly what so many women are facing, having to bring in the money, having low-quality child care. One thing that I would like to see would be a reemergence of women about particularly around children's issues, work-family issues, because I think this is a winner politically because everybody, from a conservative Christian with a Black Panther grandson to Mom, to my daughter,
Absolutely.
It's a winner.
Everybody
politically.
Faces it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Robin, thanks very much for your call. Let's get a call from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Lee's on the air. Hi, Lee.
Hi. I was calling to, I'm 22 years old, and definitely consider myself a feminist, but I find a lot of people in my generation, a lot of my friends, the people I encounter at school, are quick to say, I'm not a feminist, but, and then espouse what we have come to consider feminist views.
And why that? Why that I'm not a feminist, but?
Well, that's what I'm wondering, actually. I was wondering what the panel might speak to a little bit. Why is that so unpleasant? Why are people so afraid of it? And I think that was what was just talked about a little bit, is what some of the connotations that have been placed on the title feminist, but we know that it's so much more dynamic than that, or I think it is. That there are so many different views and there's so many different ways to be a feminist.
Yeah.
Why is it so unpleasant to people my age?
If it is, Megan, why the preamble? Why I'm not a feminist, but, and then maybe a feminist view?
Well, because the feminists that we see on TV are not the feminists like Robin. They're not the feminists like myself. They're extreme feminists. And that's the message that we're sending to the country.
Is there something wrong with that?
I think so. I think that we need to recognize that there is a vast majority of women in this country who don't consider themselves extreme feminists, and we need to draw a line and distinguish the two.
But extreme, and when I look at, say, the feminists who are on the Now People, they're basically arguing for women's rights. They're arguing for
women's
anti-discrimination,
equality.
Sex discrimination laws. They're arguing that women should be allowed to advance more in the military. Mm. I mean, I don't see really radical people representing feminism, much less so than when you had a feminist, you know, 35 years ago, who would say, let's line up all the men and shoot them. I think that much of the feminist spokespeople are pretty mainstream.
I don't think radical feminists are on TV. I think the media in this country would not put radical feminists on TV. I think it, in general, has a very conservative bent. I don't think those voices are in mainstream media at all.
Megan?
Well, I would disagree. We do see...
Who is an example of an extreme feminist that's on TV?
Well, in my opinion, I think Kate Michelman, who we've seen a lot throughout the Supreme Court nominations, is one. But I think another thing that we see is we see the results of feminism that's gone too far. We had just had a great big story about boys who are starting to fail in schools because feminism has been so concerned with promoting girls' education, which is great, but we may have taken it too far.
Yes,
but that's
yes,
why third wave feminism is promoting gender justice and not focusing on men versus women, because it's talking about how constructions of femininity and masculinity have disadvantaged both boys and girls, both men and women.
But the boys' crisis is bogus. If you look at the statistics, what you find is among white middle-class boys, there is no crisis. They're doing very well academically. They graduate from college at about the same rate as girls. When you look at overall statistics, what you see is that black, poor, and Latino boys, boys in urban areas and in regional areas, are in terrible trouble. White, affluent boys are doing very, very well, thank you.
Cindy, jump in with us here. Cindy's calling from Melrose, Massachusetts. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're good. What do you think?
Well, you know what? I think feminism has changed our lives. I'm 35 years old. Mm-hmm. I have three kids. And, you know, when my mother was raising kids in the 70s, a man changing a diaper was a radical thing. Mm. Today, we just expect that of our partners, you know?
Yeah.
They're more involved in our lives, in the kids' lives. Men pick up kids from preschool. Men stay at home. And that's as a result of feminism.
So before we get too twisted around the pole here, let's remember how much has been accomplished.
That's right. And Betty Friedan, when you read like a child-rearing thing from the 1950s, it says, oh, when your husband gets home, you should have on a fresh lipstick. The kids should be all neat and clean.
Right.
He should sit down and read the paper. Today, that's not at all our expectation. And we should remember that that's changed and that we're just waiting for corporate America to catch up, because I work part-time, my husband works full-time, and our ideal situation, having three kids under six, would be for him to work some and me to work some and us still to have health mm-hmm, insurance mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. you know.
Wouldn't that be great? But that's not there. We hear it. Remembering Betty Friedan, she wrote, each suburban wife struggled with it alone as she made the bed, shopped her groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night. She was afraid to ask, even of herself, the silent question, is this all? Carla's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Carla. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. I'm very grateful for this show, in part because I feel like, given the impact, the significance of Betty Friedan, someone who really, as your caller just said, changed the world, who wrote a book that was probably one of the most influential books of the 20th century, there's been really very little coverage and reflections about her significance since her death, when you compare it to the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor, the death of Coretta Scott King.
Yeah.
Here was sort of one of the major movements of our time, and there's really been very relatively little reflection on her significance.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, Carla. It's why we're doing it today. Carol, what do you think? Is that just because, you know, the tide of media, Coretta Scott King was so huge, there's been a lot of news on, or do you feel a kind of active resistance to celebrating, looking back on Betty?
Yes, I do. In fact, Betty Friedan was a far more significant figure historically than Coretta Scott King. I mean, Martin Luther King was
it's
huge.
A big claim.
Yeah, I mean, Coretta Scott King was a wonderful activist woman, but Martin Luther King was an icon. Betty Friedan was an icon in the realm of Dr. King. And I think part of the demonization of feminism as being about, you know, bra-burning man-haters comes out. I mean, Betty was a difficult woman. She was tough. She was feisty. No bones about it. But why not celebrate this life? And I think part of it is the continuing demonization of feminism.
Let me get one more call here. Andrea's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to know what you think about young women in the workplace. I work in the financial service industry, and I find that there are very few examples of young women in power or in higher management in my company. I walk into work every day, and I feel like I've stepped back in time. You know, all the women are in support roles, and I just want to know your opinions on what you think, how women can be better supported in corporate America.
Andrea, we hear it. Carol, here's the reality check. This is very much an unfinished story.
Very much so. What you see is with single women, there's a lot of equality. Motherhood is what makes the difference. And one of the problems is that there is no institutional support. When women have children, they often have really bad choices, either, you know, work in many cases 60 hours a week or try to find decent childcare, which is often impossible, or have husband and wife work part-time, where, you know, this is a structural issue that I would like to see women organizing around. Where the hell is decent childcare?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Masoom, is it all about motherhood? Or I think Andrea's pointing to something even bigger than that, just being a woman in that
setting.
Yeah,
it's not just about motherhood. I think that, and it's not, I don't think it's the same for all single women. I think it depends on your class status. I think it depends on your race. I think it depends on the educational opportunities that you've had access to, which is not the same for all women in this country. I think, you know, there have been gains for some. There are still many barriers. And I think that the caller's example is a perfect illustration of the fact that there's work to be done, and that this concept of choice, the fact that, you know, in certain kinds of institutions such as corporations, that there aren't women at the highest ranks, reflects the fact that women haven't had a choice throughout the life cycle, that at a certain point after they've had kids, they've had to make a choice as to whether or not they were going to keep going.
And that choice sits right there. We're not going to get it solved today. Megan, on balance, we're going forward for women, going backward.
We are going forward, and that's something that we need to remember. Women have not been in the workforce as long as men. Of course, we're not going to have equal representation right now, but it is getting better.
But our caller was only 23. She's new, so are her colleagues. Megan Greer, 23, Masoom Mamaya, 28, Carol Rivers, our eminence grease today here. Thanks to all of you for being with us. Honors to Betty Friedan. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.